Welcome to the Longevity Formula with Dr. Brandon Crawford. Let's explore the new era of wellness.
Welcome back to the Longevity Formula podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Brandon Crawford. I'm excited today. We're going to continue on with part two of our circadian biology discussions. However, this time we're going to really talk about circadian solutions, right? So how do we take this information that we started talking about last time? We're going to finish up some of that foundational work. And then we're going to really talk about how we can apply this to your life on a daily basis so that you can thrive and not just survive. So let's get into it. Moving on into this discussion about light, right? So in 2002, three independent research groups discovered a light sensing protein in the eye. This protein is in addition to the rods and the cones that we all pretty much know about. It does not provide visual acuity. Rather, it senses mainly that higher frequency blue light. And it communicates this information directly to the brain to an area called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or the SCN for short. The SCN is within the hypothalamus. I'm going to talk more about that. This protein is called melanopsin. Now, when I say blue light, I want you to think about white and blue light, right? The fluorescent lighting that you're under all the time, the screens, even the screen that I'm looking at right now, our TV screens, our phone screens, our iPad screens, all of these things are generating that high frequency white and blue light, okay? And I'm not saying that we need zero exposure to it. There's actually an optimal time to have exposure to this type of light, and that's early in the morning. The low angle sunlight, so as the sun is rising, this has a higher concentration of that blue light, and it's talking to our melanopsin, these receptors in the retina, and that's directly communicating to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And it's saying, it's morning, because I know it's morning, because I got this type of light that is only generated during the day when the sun is rising. So brain, wake up. SCN, coordinate the circadian cycles. It's morning, go, right? All right, so this melanopsin receptor, again, found in the retina, it's most sensitive to blue light. It is less sensitive to red and orange light, right? So if you spend an hour under red and orange light at night, your circadian clock is not going to be very affected. But if you spend an hour under the blue light at night or in front of your screen, right, working on your computer late into the night, scrolling on your phone, watching TV, or just sitting in your room with the lights on bright, this is going to disrupt your circadian rhythm. You could literally just be sitting in bed. You've done everything right that day. You ate the right foods. You did your time-restricted feeding. You took your supplements. You did all the right things. But you're in bed scrolling on social media at 10:30, and you're wondering why you can't go to sleep. And there's several implications besides that. You know, obviously you have the light exposure, but social media is designed to get a dopamine rise out of you. It's designed to get that dopaminergic, adrenergic, you know, spark in you so that you get more addicted to it and you keep scrolling. That's not good to promote sleep. It's just not, right? So, and yeah, by the way, could there be a best time to be working on your computer? Could there be a best time to try and get all of that stuff knocked out? I know that we can't do this all the time because some people are computer programmers or in front of a computer all the time. But yeah, that would be that early morning time, right? So as that sun's coming up, that early morning time, have your screen time. That's going to be the natural time to actually get this stuff done. If you're still on the computer after that, you need blue light blocking glasses. You just do. Or you need something like an Erlen screen in front of the computer or Erlen lens over your eyes. And we'll talk more about that information as well. So, but something else that really matters is that this melanopsin receptor, it takes a large intensity or a high amount of intensity of light exposure to excite them, right? So you could be asleep and you could, you know, wake up, you could have enough light in your eyes for visual acuity so you see what's going on, but you didn't get a high enough intensity of light to stimulate the melanopsin receptor so that circadian rhythm doesn't go, hey, it's morning, right? It's how we're designed. So if it is nighttime and you need to go to the bathroom or wake up and get a drink or something, don't flip on the bright lights. Use your phone light or use, you know, have little night lights at the, you know, close to the ground or whatever it is, but have a dim light so that you don't disrupt your circadian rhythm if you need to do those things. And again, just wake up, do the thing, go back to sleep, whatever. It's relatively normal to wake up one time a night. If you're waking up twice a night, starting to get a little disrupted. If you're waking up three or more times a night, I want you to talk to someone that understands this information, some type of physician or provider, because I don't want you to be waking up, and studies show you shouldn't be waking up more than three times a night. That is going to disrupt things. So again, light intensity matters. So even at night, you know, I of course, I'm love my photobiomodulation. So I'll either be using our lasers or LED panels, you know, pretty much every day. But oftentimes I was super busy, and the only time I have to do this is late at night, you know, maybe before bed or whatever. But I know that if I lay under my LED panel, for example, and I have the bright light, like super intense light, turned up fully, that can still disrupt my circadian rhythm because of the light intensity. So if I do this at night, I turn the red down significantly, or all the way down. So it's only the longer wavelength infrared light, which is invisible to the eye. So those are strategies that I take as well. I also will ask everyone watching to download an app. It's called the Light Meter app. This will actually measure the light intensity in your surroundings. So when the sun goes down, you can take out your phone, pull up the Light Meter app, and you can actually measure the light intensity. And ideally, you have dimmers on your lights, or you have the ability to turn off the overhead lights and turn on lamps or whatever it is. You want to keep the light intensity at or below 30 lux. So that's LUX, 30 lux. This has been proven to not disrupt circadian rhythm. So these are, they're simple strategies, but they can have huge implications. Light intensity, that, again, you can do everything right and screw this up before you go to bed and throw off your circadian rhythm, and your symphony sounds like some kind of, you know, middle school band versus, you know, a well-oiled orchestra, right? So circadian struggles in today's world. I think that you've really got a good idea, just because I've kind of talked through these, but let's really just kind of get down to the nitty gritty, right? So most developed countries, we're almost constantly in front of a screen. And I know we have to work. We got to do it. This is the society that we're in. I understand that. We cannot completely disconnect from our computer or from our phone, right? But we need to be aware that this can be driving dysfunction and health problems, and that there's actionable steps to take to prevent it. Even when people go home, again, they're sitting in front of their TV, they continue to scroll on their phone. After the sun sets, this continues, which is very disruptive. There's serious ramifications from this. There's actually studies, and I have these in the show notes. There's actually a slide I have here, and it has, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different studies on it showing how this light exposure, this blue light exposure, this overexposure on the melanopsin in the retina then translates into an increase in the incidence of diabetes and obesity, right? So direct correlation, right? Direct correlation. That should perk everyone's ears up, because no one wants diabetes. No one wants to be obese. And this simple strategy can literally either drive it or help prevent it, okay? It is that serious. So let's talk about the brain, my favorite topic, right? So in the brain, we have this area, you heard me mention it earlier, is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Now, it's a relatively small area. It only has about 20,000 cells. It is located in the hypothalamus, and it is regulating various things like hunger, satiety, sleep, fluid balance, stress response, hormones, so many, many more things, right? So this center, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, it is directly or indirectly connected to some very, very, very important areas. And from a circadian perspective, we really need to understand that it's connected to the pituitary, the adrenals, the thyroid, the gonads, and the pineal gland, right? So with the pituitary is going to be secreting our growth hormone. Now, it's not just about growth and development. This growth hormone is going to regulate things like fibrosis, scar tissue development, anabolism. This is the building up of tissues, right? So building muscle or just regenerating tissue in the body. Vasodilation, so how well blood vessels are constricting, dilating for proper blood flow. Cellular survival, cellular senescence, which is when, you know, when cellular senescence begins to go awry, that's when things like cancer starts to develop and all sorts of other metabolic issues start to happen there. Again, that's going to be a whole nother podcast topic. Cellular energy is impacted. We begin to become inflamed. Our inflammatory pathways are directly connected to our growth hormone pulses. Inotropism, which is just a fancy word for how well your muscles are contracting. We also have heart protection. So cardioprotection is directly, or heart health is directly tied to our growth hormone pulses. So this is a very, very big topic. And again, huge with the cellular senescence world and using things like peptides and stuff like that. But again, we're really just focusing on circadian rhythms at the moment. Again, the SCN is connected to our adrenal glands. I think most of us have heard about this. Most people have heard about like adrenal burnout, things like that. Our adrenals, it's producing things like adrenaline, right? So if we have that fight or flight response, we're just constantly in this, you know, this crazy world, the stress response is flying, right? This is our adrenals. Our thyroid. So our thyroid, I always tell people to think of like the thyroid as your spark plug. There's thyroid receptors scattered all over your brain and your body. I've had patients where it was a neurodevelopmental case. The kiddo was not developing. They thought maybe something like autism or something like that, but no one ever ran his labs. And we ran the labs and there was a primary hypothyroidism. And I'm not a huge advocate for medication, but in this scenario, the kid needed some thyroid hormone ASAP because that hormone does stimulate growth and development in the brain and the body. So, you know, proper referrals were made. The kid started a medication and really developed. He blew through milestones and we really didn't do anything else with the kid. That can happen. And again, it's not the typical case, but it's very important that the thyroid receptors are being stimulated and this is directly tied to our circadian rhythms. Gonads, so testicles, ovaries, there's hormonal implications with the circadian rhythm. Pineal gland. So our pineal gland produces melatonin for sleep and other things, right? So the thing about melatonin is this is becoming almost a pandemic here with doctors prescribing or recommending melatonin for so many kids, right? It's like parents are screaming that my kids don't want to go to sleep. Well, they're probably on their iPad or they're probably watching TV or they're sitting under their lights and their circadian rhythm is all off. They're not doing anything about that. And I know no one's told you about that, but then you go to the doctor and the doctor goes, let's just put them on melatonin. Well, melatonin does very important things. Like you just heard me say, the pineal gland produces it. Melatonin is the end product of the serotonin pathway. Now, that pathway is very important for several different things, but while we're sleeping, memory consolidation is involved in this, and also trauma desensitization. And there's other things too. You know, there's studies that you can delay the onset of puberty if you give kids melatonin and stuff like that. That was a mouse study, but there's still other implications. But those two things specifically, memory consolidation and trauma desensitization. So if we start loading our kids up with melatonin, this can start to have long-term ramifications on kids. So yes, we need to be considering circadian solutions, but if you have to have something in the meantime, and I'm not saying there's never a time or place for melatonin. Clinically, we typically use it for very specific neuro autoimmune situations. So if, let's say I have a kid with a neuro autoimmunity, like PANS or PANDAS or PATANS or something like this, and that dopamine receptor is hot and it's, you know, going crazy, I may use melatonin on that child, but it's because the neurochemistry and everything lines up for that to be a clinical strategy, and that's not a long-term solution. So those are some situations where I'll use it. But if you need something in the meantime to take the edge off, help you or your child go to sleep, you can use something called apigenin. That is an extract from chamomile tea. It's very safe, very well tolerated. I want you to talk to your doctor before doing it, of course. And that's true for anything that I'm recommending. But apigenin, depending on, you know, I'm not going to give doses for kids because I think you should be working with a physician, but most people start with around 50 milligrams or so. Adults, I typically start around 100 milligrams. And the first effects are typically muscle relaxation. So you start to just kind of get that heavy feeling, that tired feeling. And then if you increase the dose just a little bit more, then you'll get that more sedative type of, it's not like a sedative, but it starts to make you tired and sleepy and go to sleep. It has not been proven to disrupt any of your sleep cycles or anything like that. Has not been shown to have any kind of hormonal dysregulatory effects or whatever. So that's a much safer option. Of course, things like magnesium, specifically magnesium 3 and 8, because it gets into the brain easier. Those are some other strategies to come off of that melatonin. So another interesting fact about the suprachiasmatic nucleus is as soon as you wake up, your SCN is marking time. And so for every 1 hour that you're awake, you actually need to sleep for 20 to 30 minutes. And your SCN is marking time. You're not going to fool it. Studies show that sleep deprivation can be worse than consuming alcohol based on cognitive performance. So if your little kiddo is staying up too late, or they have a screen in front of them too much at night, or they have any of these things, you know, going against them that we've talked about, it's like sending little Timmy to school after drinking a couple of beers. Probably not a good idea. Probably not going to have the best academic outcome. So if you're having behavioral challenges at school, if you're having academic challenges at school, focus and attention challenges at school, maybe rather, you know, instead of just saying, hey, I think my kid has ADHD or something like that, which absolutely we would love to check your kiddo out, you know, go to a qualified professional, help you out. And there's things like looking at primitive reflexes and stuff like that that can help that child. But what if that brain is not integrated properly because of a disrupted circadian biology, right? So rather than sitting there and trying to integrate a spinal reflex, vibrating the back all day, but little Timmy is still staying up too late and still has this poor light exposure, they're still malilluminated, good luck integrating that reflex. I've seen it. This is why so many people struggle with this primitive reflex thing. They go, I get it all the time. I've had people reach out to me saying, I've been doing this method for primitive reflexes and this is supposed to integrate and it's not. And I go, what does bedtime look like? When do they eat? What does light exposure look like? And they go, oh my gosh, this is terrible. Because then you lay it out and you go, they're chronically inflamed, their brain is dysregulated, their neurotransmitters are dysregulated, and you're not going to fix that by just stimulating a primitive reflex. Not going to happen, because that's not how we're designed to work, right? So there are sleep parameters. There's been research done on the most advantageous amounts of sleep, right? So a newborn should be getting around 14 to 17 hours of sleep per day. An infant, about 12 to 15. Toddlers, 11 to 14 hours. And I have this lined out in the show notes and everything. Preschool age, which is your 3 to 5 year olds, 10 to 13 hours. School age, your 6 to 13 year olds, 9 to 11 hours. Your teenagers, 14 to 17 years old, 8 to 10 hours. Your young adults, 18 to 25 year olds, 7 to 9 hours, adults, 7 to 9 hours, and your older adults, for some reason, drop off to 7 to 8 hours. I would still say probably 7 to 9 hours. So again, those are in the show notes. Interestingly enough, when the suprachiasmatic nucleus is surgically removed or degenerates, and we see this degenerate in things like various neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's or dementia, Alzheimer's, things like that, all circadian rhythms become disrupted, right? So yes, the brain controls a lot of this. Yes, the genetics control a lot of this. But remember, the brain is that central system receiving the data from the environment, right? And that is setting the tone for that symphony of life, right? So when we lose that area, all circadian rhythms become disrupted. So like I said earlier, the melanopsin receptors in the retina, they communicate directly to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Blue light tells the SCN that it's early morning and to begin the early day circadian rhythms. This light, again, like I said earlier, is concentrated in that low angle sunlight. So as the sun is rising, this is where the highest concentration of that type of light is found. Let's talk about the brain injury world for a little bit, because that's where I spend a lot of time clinically. And yes, we treat all types of things, you know, ranging from brain injuries to chronic pain disorders to autism, neurobehavioral disorders, you name it. But I've had a lot of time and energy and effort spent in brain injury. And so if someone does experience something like neurostorming, right? And this is something where if you know, you know, right? So neurostorming, a common scenario is there is a non-fatal drowning and the kiddo goes through this terrible period of time called a neurostorm. I've had patients where they were in such extreme neurostorming that the back of their head was touching their butt, right? They were completely bent back, completely folded over because of the type of muscular changes and reflexive things that happen with this. You get this really increased heart rate, intense sweating, the blood pressure is going really high, and medication doesn't really touch this. There's nothing that can really be done. I do have a case study on my site where we actually completely eliminated a neurostorm within a week of our intensive care. And that was a really cool thing. But again, we were applying all of these things I'm talking about, right? But if someone went through that neurostorm, that is also called a hypothalamic storm. The hypothalamus was involved. And again, the SCN is located in the hypothalamus. So we know if you went through this neurostorm, your circadian biology is dysfunctional. It has been disrupted, right? And there's not one of our more severe brain injury patients that has come through that does not have sleep disturbances or gut dysfunction or some type of pain syndrome or some type of fluid buildup. I have a lot of patients that just get this puffy fluid, you know, just everywhere. They look like they're about to pop. Everything is so swollen. Again, fluid balance, heavily connected to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the circadian biology, and all of these networks and everything are coming together to even control that, right? So this is something missed by clinical professionals all the time. They sit there and they just give a laxative. They sit there and they just, you know, prescribe a diuretic. They do these things. No one says how much light is your kid getting? How much outdoor time? How late, you know, are you giving them this? Or how late are they getting light exposure? I've had kids that are constantly in front of an iPad all day. And there's reasons for some of this. And I understand that, you know, there's mechanisms at play there. I get it. But we still need to be thinking about how this can disrupt our circadian biology. If we're not having those conversations, we're missing strategic windows in to help someone. So again, you can reset this area. You can regain control over many of these areas in brain injury. I'm not going to say you're going to end up exactly how you were prior to the injury, but I can promise you, we rarely see anyone that does not improve. I don't know that we've ever seen anyone that did not improve, at least to a small degree. When we start to address circadian biology, we start to influence cellular senescence, we start to be able to actually generate positive neuroplasticity, and that's how you get your functional improvements, and that's how you get your sustainable changes. So one of the most important aspects of setting our circadian clocks is when and how we wake up, okay? So we should wake up 30 to 60 minutes before the sunrise, or at least as the sunlight begins to peak over the horizon. This is ingrained in us because, as you know, if you go back hundreds of years, we didn't have this nice bed to sleep in. We weren't completely protected by the house, etc. We had to wake up and actually prepare for the day. We had to go out and start hunting food or gathering food. And if we woke up 30 to 60 minutes before the sunrise, that allowed us to strategically position ourselves for the hunt. Right. And so we learned from an evolutionary standpoint that if that's when we wake up, we have the highest probability of capturing food. Right. And so we would go, we would set ourselves up, and then the sun comes up, and then we can begin the hunt. Right. So during the night, also, why we should wake up like this, right? So during the night, our heart rate, our blood pressure begins to rise in response to the buildup of cortisol. But again, going back to the brain injury discussion, what if you've been feeding all night? What if you've been told by your medical professional it's just easier to feed them all night so you don't have to deal with it during the day? And you don't have that actually is a large disruption of circadian rhythm. I'm going to tell you more about it. So close to early morning, again, you start to get this increase in heart rate and blood pressure. This starts to increase your core body temp. So in order to go to sleep, your core body temperature needs to actually drop by about 1 to 2 degrees. And in order to wake up, you need your core body temperature to rise 1 to 2 degrees. And so you actually see, if you track your sleep, I was looking at my heart rate the other day. It was, you know, riding in the, you know, upper 40s, low 50s. And then as the night drew longer, the heart rate started to go up and up and up and up. And then before I woke up, it was hitting its peak. And then I woke up. And that's how it should happen. Now, after waking up, we should actually have this peak of sex hormones, particularly testosterone. Now, this actually appears to be, and there is research on this, there's actually some interesting articles. This seems to be the optimal neurophysiological time for sex. And here's, I'll just throw this out there. If you're someone that you're struggling with like erectile dysfunction or, you know, some type of hypoarousal dysfunction or whatever it may be, but you're only trying to have sex at night, right? Well, at night, again, your pineal gland is releasing melatonin. You're getting ready for sleep. You're not getting ready for sexual activity, right? I'm not saying you can't do it then. Obviously, most people do. But rather than just thinking I'm broken or something's going on here, and you actually have some of your lowest testosterone actually late at night, right? So if we want to really be in proper neurophysiological alignment, morning is going to be the best time for that. Your gut motility actually begins to speed up. Your muscles begin to get more blood flow in the morning and prepare for movement. Neurotransmitters begin to sync up and optimize, so you have an awake brain that cannot properly function. Right after waking early in the morning is the best time for your creative thinking. So if you need to solve a problem, do in the morning. Wake up, maybe have some sexual activity. You got your movement in, you got your stretching in, brain's firing. Start to solve your problems. That's a great time of day to start to do it, right? So your brain is fresh. Memories have been consolidated overnight. Pathways are free of clutter. Our glymphatic system has been active during the night. That's like the street sweepers and the trash trucks coming in, getting all the debris, all the metabolic debris and everything that's been created during the day. And you're cleaning all that junk out of the brain. So you should be free of inflammation. Your brain should be free of inflammation, which really starts to bog down brain function, right? You start to get that brain fog and fatigue, right? So early morning, best time for that creative thinking. So what else should we do? Okay, so we should wake up, we should move, we should go for a walk, we should stretch, we should swim. I want you to do something that you enjoy, right? Something you enjoy so that there's a lesser of a barrier, right? I don't want you to think, oh my gosh, I don't want to do this. I want you to do something you enjoy. But early morning is not really when we're designed to be doing our high intensity type of exercise. Now, clinically, like I was saying, we actually time our therapies, right? So when we have someone do intensive care with us and they're with us for a week or several weeks or whatever it may be, we'll actually use the morning for our passive care, more of our sensory stimulus and whatnot, and then come back in the afternoon, specifically from a neurophysiological standpoint, from a circadian standpoint, 4 to 7 p.m. is kind of the optimal time. So after lunch, right, we'll bring a patient back, and that's when we'll do the more intense movements, the more involved and complicated movements based on circadian biology. So in a lot of these conditions, like I was just talking about with neurostorming, brain injury, sometimes we need to step up our game a little bit clinically, right? And this is why I've had to rely on things like photomedicine, things like laser therapy. This is huge, right? Because yes, we need to get that sunlight exposure, absolutely. But we need to heal some very damaged systems. So we need to bring in some very powerful yet safe tools like the lasers that we use every day. But this also applies for those scenarios like jet lag and sleeping disorders and insomnia and pain syndromes and all these things, because this is, again, when we use the proper wavelengths of light, we can start to have local effects. So this can have positive effects on those local tissues, the genetics within the cells. There's research that shows the correct wavelengths of light with the right parameters do start to influence epigenes, and we start to get that genetic influence as well. But then also on the brain, we can start to reset the genetic code, the genetic biology, the circadian biology with the proper use of laser and light therapy. And that's why we've been using it like we have. Now, I want you to only, you know, pursue this from doctors and therapists that really know what they're doing, because a lot of people really don't understand this. I mean, think about it. When's the last time your doctor talked to you about circadian biology? That doctor, the same one that's maybe using a laser for a sprained ankle, they're not going to know how to apply this to your brain or to your circadian biology or whatever it may be, right? So this has been paramount, and this has had huge, huge implications to helping someone really break through plateaus and really establish proper circadian rhythms much faster. And that's why we continue to use laser therapy like we do, right? So another extremely important topic that we need to go through is how and when we eat, right? So the first bite of the day is extremely, extremely important. Your liver and metabolic circadian genes respond less to light. And I hate to say that, but they do. They respond less to light and more to the timing of when you're eating, right? So your first meal or your first bite, I don't want to say meal because I want you to understand even a bite is going to influence this. So your first bite and your last bite of food or drink, right? So some type of calorie dense drink, whether it be alcohol, milk, whatever that counts, anything besides water. That is going to set in motion your metabolic circadian genes. Most research has been done on the liver here. So extremely important, man. When we eat, what we eat, highly important, but we're really talking about when right now, right? So this is referred to as time-restricted feeding. There is an optimal window that has been discovered of 8 to 12 hours. So we have this 8 to 12 hour window of time that we should consume all of our calories, all of our food. There's also information that tells us we should stop consuming food 2 to 4 hours before we go to sleep. So let's say 3 hours before we go to sleep. All right, so we just defined some parameters. We need to eat for 8 to 12 hour window of time. That's it. And we need to stop eating 3 hours before we go to bed. Okay, so let's say if you plan to be asleep by 10, you need to not consume any food or calories after 7. From 7, now we have the definition of that 8 to 12 hour window of time. So now you can determine when to start eating, right? So that's how I want you to start thinking through this. What time are you going to sleep? Here's the time of your last bite. Here's your window of time, right? This is, by the way, a leading cause, a big problem with the development of type 2 diabetes, and the research supports it. Dr. Panda actually developed an app that you can use to track your feeding window. So if you go to mycircadianclock.org, you can actually download this app. I believe it's free, but you can actually track what you eat. And based on their research, most people are consuming calories within an 18-hour window of time, so well outside of the optimal range. Right. So again, a lot of our patients are coming to us that are on this night feeding schedule, right? This is the brain injury patient. Typically, sometimes in rare, I've seen a CRPS patient like this, but typically that very severe brain injury patient. And I understand that it may be easier. And I understand that a medical professional probably told you to do this, but you have to understand that there's reasons, well-defined reasons, that we should not be doing this, right? We are designed to consume food during the day, and not even all throughout the day. We get a meal and then we're done eating, and then we're moving. We get a meal and we're done, and we're moving. We get a meal and we're done, right? And I'm not saying 3 meals is optimal. I'm just giving an example. Nowhere in our evolutionary history or anything, nowhere has it ever been advantageous for us to be fed all through night. That is completely disruptive to all of our metabolic genes, to all of our metabolic circadian cycles, to our brain, right? Your brain is cleaning itself, is getting the glymphatics going, is consolidating memories. But if, again, if you're feeding, right, if you're putting food into your system, the brain has to stop doing that. And it has to put blood flow and concentration into autonomic nuclei so you can begin to digest that food and produce digestive enzymes and do all of these things, because it has to deal with this food coming in. And so you start to get this very inflamed brain. You start to get this very swollen individual. You start to get chronic GI disruption and so on, right? I can tell you story after story after story of brain injury patients that we've seen that this has been a problem. I can even show you where timing of eating alters gait patterns, right? And that wasn't a brain injury study, but even your timing of when you eat and when you have light exposure, this can even alter how your muscles function. So very important topic there. I do advise everyone, right, that if we're not sleeping, if we're not eating, then ideally we're moving in some type of way, right? Whether it's, you know, you're at a desk and you're standing, or you're on a rocker board, or you're on a treadmill. Fortunately for me, for the doctors in my office, for a therapist, we're working with patients all day. I love that. We're constantly moving. But again, if you're not sleeping, if you're not eating, we need to be moving. Ideally, we're moving in the sunlight, because if we're in the sunlight, then our suprachiasmatic nucleus, our brain, knows what time of day it is, and it's constantly keeping track. It's going, okay, I no longer have that low angle sunlight. It's midday, have these nice far infrared. Oh, and now the sun's going down, and it's better keeping track of time that way, right? Not to mention we're getting proper fuel for our cells, for our mitochondria. This is just better overall. Again, think about that city we talked about, right? Austin, Texas. We have to get good data in to give good data out and good commands out, right? So at minimum, I want you to be outside early as the sun rises. I want you to catch that low angle sunlight midday when the sun's peaking. Again, I want you outside. I want you to get those longer far infrared light wavelengths. And then as the sun is setting, I want you to make sure that you're getting exposure then outside as well. Do not wear sunglasses when you get these exposures. That can disrupt things, right? We need and I'm not saying stare at the sun. That's not what I'm saying. But be outside without sunglasses on. I also want you to get as much skin exposure as possible, right? So it's less advantageous if we go outside and we're completely covered up and we have our sunglasses on. It's like we're shielding ourselves from the thing that is telling our cells and our systems what to do. That's not good. So as much as you possibly can, I'm not saying run around naked, but as much as you can, get skin exposure, get your light, get your eyes exposed to light, right? Now, at midday is where we need to greatly reduce the amount of blue light exposure that we're getting. So wear your blue light blocking glasses. I have some recommendations, reduce your screen time, etc. After the sun goes down, we really need to go to zero blue light exposure. That's extremely important. So screens go away after the sun goes down. We're reducing the light exposure. Again, download the light meter app. Keep your light intensity at 30 lux or lower. Extremely important for your kids too. Okay. So there's some blue blocking glasses that I love. They're the True Dark glasses. Dave Asprey is the founder of this company. And so you can actually use the code Crawford10 at checkout and you can get a discount on those. There's actually lights that he's put together as well. It's pretty cool. So if you go to shoptrulight.com, you can actually get a light that you can program. So early in the day, you get more blue light exposure, and then you can transition it to more of the yellow light and then transition into more red light as the day progresses. This is good for, you know, your office or your house or whatever. Again, I've got a code Crawford10 off if you want to get a discount on those. Now, Erlen lens therapy is actually more ideal here, right? Because with Erlen syndrome, that's I-R-L-E-N, you can actually have a problem processing certain wavelengths of light. And this can create a chronic stress response in the brain, which can then help facilitate all types of problems, right? So if you can actually find the wavelength of light that you need to have in front of your eyes to actually reduce that chronic stress response, this can be extremely advantageous I have my Erlen lens. Dr. Jerry Levine is the one that I have everyone work with for this. You can reach out to our office if you need help with that. That's neurosolutionatx.com if you want more information on that. And again, our last bite or meal of the day should be ideally 2 to 4 hours before we go to sleep. This is, I cannot stress how important this is. If we're doing everything right, but then we're sitting under too much light, and we even eat a little snack before we go to bed, this can have big ramifications. This can be very, very bad, right? Now, there's other things to consider, things like temperature. I talked about how core body temp needs to change. I just want to give a little information about why cold exposure can be a big deal. Because a lot of the implications to light for circadian rhythm are coming from your UV light, specifically your UVA light. What if you're living in an area that does not get a lot of UV light exposure, like London? Big area, cloudy all the time. It's a higher latitude. Now, I'm not saying this replaces the UV light exposure. It doesn't. You still need more. Like, you need more outdoor time if you're in that higher latitude. But cold exposure, so actually doing your cold plunges, your cells actually generate UV light. This is a survival mechanism, right? So cold exposure, there's so many reasons why to do it, why to do your cold plunges. Things like resetting your dopamine systems, vagus nerve activation, better autonomic tone, better blood flow. But your cells will actually generate a small amount of UV light. This can generate cellular energy. This can help to restore some circadian dysfunction. So just another reason to do it. I would suggest doing it early in the day, right? So wake up, move, do your cold plunge, continue on with your day, right? So big overview summary, right? We need to be paying attention to our light exposure. We are mal-illuminated. We're getting bad types of light. We need good types of light, which is sunlight. We need to get our sleep right. Sometimes we may need some help with that. We may need to use some magnesium. We may need to use some apigenin while we're doing all the things right to help reset these circadian clocks. But once we do start to really restore things, typically after a few weeks of doing these things I'm telling you to, specifically the moving and the feeding component, your sleep cycles start to reset. So if you're doing your time-restricted feeding, really paying attention to that 8 to 12-hour window and not eating 3 hours before sleep, this starts to reset things very quickly. And moving, there's studies that show strenuous physical exercise improves sleep, right? We can't ignore that. So light, sleep, feeding, moving, this is how we reset our systems. This is how we really start to change our circadian biology. This is how we really start to produce that symphony we call life.
We hope today's episode has inspired you to take that next step toward your best self. Remember, the path to longevity is paved with small, daily decisions. Your journey is unique, and every step, every choice, brings you closer to your ultimate vision of a healthier, happier life. For more insights, tips, and resources, visit drbrandoncrawford.com.